Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Namaste Radio. The intent of our programming is to increase awareness, inspire loving action, and ignite transformation and healing in our listeners, and through them, our world. Namaste Radio is brought to you by Namaste Publishing. Please join its interactive spiritual community. Communicate directly with authors, guest bloggers, and others like yourself who are spiritually seeking a better way of living. Connect, make friends, and be one with our new Namaste Global community at namastepublishing.com. And now, please welcome your host for this hour, Marie Bernard, on Namaste Radio, radio that will change your life. Hello, welcome to Namaste Radio. Good evening. I'm your host, Marie. Thank you so much for joining me. Tonight's guest is Paul Rademacher, and he is the author of A Spiritual Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe, Travel Tips for the Spiritually Perplexed, and he is also the executive director of the very well-known Monroe Institute. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thanks, Marie. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. Well, I've been reading your book, and it's fascinating. It tells the story of, well, your journey on how you found your way to studying through the theology school and in your work as a Presbyterian minister. Is that the right term? Pastor?
Yes, it is.
and also to your work towards the Monroe Institute and your journey with that. Now, you started out having an experience where you fell off a roof and you had a spiritual, was it an out-of-body experience? Was it an apparition? What do you call it?
Well, you know, that's one of the problems that you run into in this kind of thing is that the words always fail when it comes to trying to communicate it to another person. So, I mean, some people would call it an out-of-body experience. Some people think it has earmarks of a near-death experience. But for me, it's just an experience I had that ended up really changing my life in ways that I could have never predicted.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for sharing your work with us in your book. And if you are listening right now and you want to get on the air to ask a question, the number to call is 1-347-202-0129. That's 347-202-0129. I'll put you on the air and you can speak with Paul Rademacher right now if you'd like to ask a question. I just went through the book and I kind of came up with all of these questions, and I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about your experience. I just would like to jump right in as soon as you're ready with my questions.
Okay. All right. Well, let me give you. I'll go ahead and give you a background on the experience that changed my life. As you mentioned, I was working in the construction industry. My brother and I had a company. We were building a house, and I was up on the roof one day and ended up pulling on a board, and to my surprise, the board gave way, and I ended up falling off the roof. It was an awkward way in which I landed. I didn't have time to adjust for the fall, and I ended up fracturing my left hip, though I didn't know it at first. They took me to the hospital and did x-rays, and when they did the x-rays, they didn't find any fracture in the hip, and so they put me in physical therapy, which, if you do have a fractured hip, is really not where you want to end up at all.
No.
But, I was having a really rough time with that, and the doctor came by and he said, I think we'd better take another look at that hip. So they did some more x-rays, found out that there was a fracture, and they took me out of physical therapy and put me into traction. And when the doctor told me that I was going to be off work for a number of weeks, I found myself going into a spiral downward of pain and anxiety, pain because the hip was so excruciating, and anxiety because this was the busiest time of our construction year, and there was absolutely no way I could possibly be off work. So I felt myself going down, and not really even in a metaphorical way, but literally, I could feel myself spiraling downward, when all of a sudden I broke through into another reality. And in that other reality, the pain in the hip completely vanished, the anxiety dissipated entirely, and I found myself surrounded by complete and total peace. And I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that there were no such things as accidents, and everything had meaning and purpose. And at some point in that experience, I found myself standing in front of a being of light, and We're conversing about my life, and yet we're not using words. And it was such a profound thing for me, because if I had heard of those kinds of things, it certainly wasn't about to happen to somebody like me who was just an ordinary guy. You'd think you'd have to be studying this for you know, decades. But for me, it was just a spontaneous thing that happened. And all of a sudden, here I am in a different reality. And when I came out of that, I was profoundly affected, because I had, for me, the answer to a question that had been really on my mind for almost a year before that. I was having a sense of calling to go into the ministry, and so I figured, well, obviously, this is the voice of God. And so I went off to seminary with my wife and two children at that time. But over the years, I began to realize that the real purpose of that experience was to create a hunger in me to want to get back to that world again and to try to understand it and integrate it more into my life than I thought was possible. And I didn't realize it, but that would end up being my life's work literally from that point on.
So, Paul, a big part of your book, A Spiritual Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe, was your work as a minister and how it was kind of conflicting with your inner spiritual search. There's a lot of talk about the Bible, and I mean, there's so many people interpret the words of Jesus Christ and the Bible in so many different ways, and it sounded like you really were having a struggle trying to conform and keep up appearances of this holy man while you're doing this internal work that a regular Christian might look at as satanic even.
Well, you know, of course, again, everybody has labels for things, but when you have a very compelling experience like that, and it's that mystical experience that took me into the ministry, it was very difficult for me, because I felt, as I reflected on this as the years went by, I really began to believe that this kind of movement into other dimensions and other awarenesses and other perceptions beyond the physical world had a lot to do with what Jesus was talking about when he would talk about the kingdom of heaven. Because he would say things like, the kingdom of heaven is within you, or the kingdom of heaven is among you, or some of you will not taste death before you see the kingdom coming in all of its glory. So in each one of those, he was talking about something that was a present reality. But so many in the church were preoccupied with the idea of what happens to us after we die. And so I began to feel like the church was missing so much that was critical to who Jesus was and what he was trying to communicate. And yet at the same time, I didn't want to say that too loudly, because I had by that time now three children and a wife to support, and I really kind of wanted to keep my job. And so it was a real battle for me on an inner plane to decide, you know, how do I approach this? What do I do about this? And can I communicate what to me was so essential? And I learned over the years, because I was basically not very courageous, that if I was going to say something, I probably should couch it in language that wouldn't be too radical. And I remember that at the end of the service, I'd be preaching on something, and people would come out and they'd say, oh, that was the most wonderful sermon, that was just great. And my wife would be standing next to me, and she'd whisper in my ear, if they had any idea what you were really talking about, you'd lose your job tomorrow. So it was a bit of a struggle for me, to be sure.
Well, I'd like to discuss the issue of people who claim that they can hear God, because that in the Bible, I mean, Jesus claims he's the Son of God, and he's got this direct link to God. And if someone today were to say that, we would just assume that they were suffering from some kind of psychosis.
Right.
So, yeah, I want to discuss that, because it's so important. What's your perception of what happens when someone says, I talk to God?
Well, first thing I've learned in this work is, you know, I don't really, it's kind of fruitless to judge another person's experience. Because that is their experience, and it isn't something that you can convince somebody of the fact that they might be delusional. But, you know, when you look at the Bible, as you mentioned, there were many, many people who had a sense of hearing the voice of God, or, you know, Abraham moving from hearing the voice of God that took him from his country into a foreign land, and all kinds of people who talked with angels and had these experiences that transcended the physical world. And what I find is interesting for so many within the Judeo-Christian tradition is that, you know, they will read those passages in the Bible and they'll say, well, you know, obviously that can't happen to us today. That happened to people in the Bible because somehow they're different from us. But really, if you talk with people and really listen to them, you find that we get all kinds of communication that come to us. Sometimes we might call it an intuition. Sometimes we might call it a gut feeling. Sometimes we might call it a special kind of guidance or insight, or a voice coming to us in the middle of the night. These are all ranges of experience that are available to us as human beings, because I think we're constantly in communication, not just with this physical world and the people that we know within it, but there's communication that's happening to us always from other worlds, metaphysical worlds, non-physical worlds, that I think if we learned to pay attention to those more, would dramatically enrich our experience in this world, and also probably influence some of the decisions that we make to our benefit.
So, Paul, do you think that things have changed now? It seems like in the 21st century, we're starting to come back to maybe not the realization, but having an open enough mind to believe that maybe someone could be talking with God. For instance, like Neil Donald Walsh has his book Conversations with God, and
yes,
maybe
right.
50 years ago that would have been like, whoa, really out there. What do you think it is in our society that is changing so that we're getting back to that point?
Oh, it's such a great question. I think it's a very insightful question. From my perspective, I think what has happened is we pushed the search and the exploration of the physical world so far, and to such an exclusion of the spiritual world, that and we've had great success in doing so, because the scientific worldview has really created a much better lifestyle for so many of us, with a lot of success and a lot of healing and whatnot. But the problem with that is that it's also created a bit of an imbalance, because we have been so preoccupied with that material world and the manipulation of that material world that it has created a hunger or a thirst, a yearning for something that may be even deeper than that. And I think that's the whole spiritual exploration, the metaphysical exploration that is now a kind of blossoming within our society. In the Eastern societies, you know, they've kept that up and running for a long time, and it's part and parcel of the way they look at the world. But we have lost that, and I think people are now beginning to realize at a soul level that we've been impoverished because of it, and that yearning, that deep longing, is propelling a lot of people to move out into this search. So I think that maybe from a cultural, maybe from an evolutionary perspective, the time is right for us now to go back to some extent and reclaim that which we have lost before.
Beautiful. Well, and at the same time, though, this is something that was kind of a common thread that ran through your book, was the statement that we are more afraid of our genius than our darkness. We're afraid to step into our power. Why do you think that is? I mean, you struggled with that yourself.
Well, I think that part of the reason is because often when we go to pursue our real passion, you know, the thing that we were created for, and the thing that we were designed to bring into this world, which is unique to each of us, when we start to get close to that, inevitably we're going to run headlong into the mores of our culture, or the expectations of those around us, or the dreams that our parents had for us that don't match up with that. And so to follow the heart and to pursue that where it leads us can be very, very difficult, simply because it places us at odds with so many of the voices that have become important to us in our culture. And that pursuing that passion also can put us at odds with the ability to earn what we think is a good living. I mean, that was one of the things that I struggled with all the time, was being in the ministry and coming out and saying what was really on my mind could put me in jeopardy for keeping my job. And that's, you think, well, that's not such a big thing, but it isn't just about me. You know, it is about my kids and about my wife and about their well-being. And so it's really an interesting part of the struggle. And I think that I've begun to realize over the years that that's not by accident. I think that it really is a step in the spiritual maturity that we have to go through, where we're coming up against those other voices and finding the courage to go and do what we know we need to do, even though we think it may cost us something. In the long run, I think that it works to our advantage, but we can't really see that until we make those choices and those hard questions come before us.
Thank you for answering that, Paul. We are speaking right now with Paul Rademacher. If you want to get on the air and ask a question, the number is 347-202-0129. That's 347-202-0129. Paul Rademacher is the executive director of the Monroe Institute, and I want to talk about the Monroe Institute in a little bit. But first, there was a story in the book, and when I read this story, I've kind of heard variations of it before, but when I read it this time, I got like shivers down my spine. It was just like, woo. It was the story of the carpet weaver.
Oh, yeah, right.
And I was wondering if, because I'm sure you tell it so much better than I would you share that with us right now?
Well, I have to go back and kind of remember exactly how it went myself.
Do you want me to refresh your memory?
Well, give me I remember the story in the broad outlines. I'm trying to think of exactly how that.
His son had broken his leg,
right.
And all the neighbors came running, and they were like, "Oh no,
yeah.
What a tragedy!" And he was like, "Well, right. it's all for the best."
Right, right.
And
so, yeah. So the story actually begins with some other incidents. I think there was one where he lost a horse and the neighbors were all upset, and he said it's all for the best, and they couldn't understand that. And the horse came back again, and they said, "Oh, it's a great thing. We should celebrate." And he just said, "It's all for the best." And several of those sequences happened, and then, as you said, his son fell off the horse, broke his leg, and the neighbors were all upset. They said, "Oh, this is the worst thing that could possibly happen. I can't imagine it." And he says, "It's all for the best." And then after that, then the king's army comes through, and they are conscripting all the young men into the service of the king, and they bypass his son who has a broken leg, and again, it's all for the best. And so the end of the story, he talks about being a weaver, and on the backside of whatever he's weaving, it looks like a hodgepodge of threads going everywhere, but when you turn it around and you look from the other side, then the beauty of the work shines through, and it's a completely different perspective. So the idea behind the story, obviously, is that when we are able to view things from a different perspective, then that changes everything, and certainly the circumstances of this world. And so, in a sense, I guess the story is asking us to kind of back up from our deep immersion of the trials and tribulations of the world, and to take a bit of a longer distance view of it, and then we can see this beautiful tapestry that's taking place and transforming our lives as we go.
Beautiful, thank you. Do you feel like your own journey, I mean, through some of the struggles that you were going through, I mean, you were dealing with feeling really unsatisfied in your work as a minister, if you had it to do over again, would you go back and maybe make changes sooner, or do you feel like everything kind of unfolded just exactly how it was supposed to?
You know, that's a really good question, too. I think when we see things in retrospect, that gives us the ability to back up a little bit and see the thread or the narrative arc of our lives. And you know, when I was in the midst of it, it was so difficult. But now that I view it from this perspective, I know that there were so many things I had to learn along the way that probably couldn't have been learned except for doing and going through the process of what I did. And that really prepared me, I think, for what I'm doing now. When I look at my years in the ministry, you know, there were so many things I had to learn in terms of dealing with people, patience, public speaking, and on and on, administration. And now I'm finding that all of those things are being used in ways that I could have never foreseen when I was in the midst of it. So would I do it over again differently? You know, probably not. I think that there is a certain genius that is folded into our lives right from the beginning if we're open to it.
Wonderful. Well, Paul, there was a point in the book where you were telling the story about the moment that your friend had to have an open chest cavity. He had had a really bad situation happening, and he had to have his chest cavity left open for some time while he healed internally. And you were looking in, and you were looking for him, and you couldn't see him. Can you tell us a little more about what that experience was like?
Well, my friend was going, I think he had some kind of infection he had undergone heart surgery, and they had to leave the chest open, and they covered it over with a clear film. It was the first time I've ever had the opportunity to look into somebody else's body. You know, we often talk about feeling into somebody else or getting a sense of somebody else or being one with them, but I never had the experience of actually looking physically into the chest cavity of another person. It was really startling to me. Now, mind you, I've seen all kinds of people who have gone through all kinds of surgeries, and I've escorted people, you know, through the death process. But this was the first time that I'd seen somebody who was alive, and yet I could see into their very inner workings. So here I'm, my friend's unconscious, right, and he's in the ICU, and they've got him hooked up to all kinds of instruments that were keeping the body alive. And there was this visceral reaction that I had when I was looking into his chest cavity. I thought, wait a minute, where is he? You know, we're so used to identifying people with their bodies. You know, we see them, we see their face, and there's that flash of recognition, and we see the shape of their body, and we say, that's my friend Porter, or that's Sally, or that's Mary. But this time, when I looked into the physical body, and knowing that he was unconscious, it really was ridiculous to think that we live within our physical bodies. It was absurd as I was watching him, because my friend was nowhere to be found. There was this body that was functioning. The heart was pumping. The lungs were inflating and deflating, and yet he was nowhere to be seen. And it was one of those experiences that registered at a deep level for me when I realized without a doubt that not only are we more than our physical bodies, but the essence of who we are is much more than the physical body, such that the physical body is actually almost contained within us rather than the other way around, which ordinarily we think that we are contained within the physical body. But I don't think that's true at all.
Interesting. Well, there was another quote in your book, and again, if you want to get on the air and ask Paul a question. He is the executive director of the Monroe Institute, and I'm going to ask you a little bit about that in just a minute, but the number is 347-202-0129 if you want to get on the air, 347-202-0129. You can also ask a question in the chat room. If you are a member of Blog Talk Radio, you can join in the chat and ask your question there if you're shy to get on the air, and I'll pass that on. But, Paul, in your book, You also mentioned that one of the things the Monroe Institute says is that many come to the Monroe Institute looking for an out-of-body experience, and what they don't realize is that they've never had a truly in-body experience. And I think that ties in with the story of your friend. I mean, if people are looking for an out-of-body experience and they really need to have an inner-body experience, then why is it that we can't see that when you were looking at inside your friend's body?
You're right. Well, you know, so often I think that we don't realize it, but you know, we change our perspective almost minute by minute. And if you are paying attention, you realize that we actually pay very little attention to the physical world as we go through our day. Very often we are thinking about what has just happened or the distant past, and maybe we're reworking it in our minds or regretting what we had said or wishing that something had turned out differently. Or we're thinking about the future and anticipating what's going to happen to us in the next meeting, or what's going to happen to us when we go to the football game, or what's going to happen to us in the next conversation, what's going to happen to us in our career, and so forth. And so we actually spend very little time being present to this world and present to the physical body. And so because we're preoccupied, so much of this world simply escapes our notice. I don't know if you've ever had the experience of traveling, driving down the interstate highway, and all of a sudden you realize you've gone 60 miles down the highway, and you have no idea what has transpired in the meantime. Where have you been at that point in time? Who's driving the car? It's some other part of you, but the conscious part of you really isn't aware of what's going on. And I think that this work that we do at the Institute and that we help people to move toward is to become more and more aware of our perceptions, not only in the non-physical world, but also in the physical world, such that when you become more and more sensitized, you open up to both worlds. And so it isn't a question of either or, it's a question of both and simply being more and more present to the experiences that are available to us as human beings. And I think that's the key to it all. It's both out of body and so both in body. Both are precious to who we are as human beings.
Okay, that makes sense. And what do you think, I guess maybe this is answering my question already, but the Monroe Institute, I mean, people go there in search of having an out-of-body experience. But aside from, like, the fun of that experience, what do people get out of that they take with them?
Do you mean in terms of long-term benefits?
Long-term benefits for them and the world. I mean, what kind of impact is it having when people go within and search spiritually? It would be really cool to have that experience and really fun, and sometimes, you know, we chase these mystical experiences. But what, like you said, long term, what really is changing within us when we have those experiences?
Right. Well, you know, the perennial wisdom has always been know thyself. And if we only know ourselves to be identified with our physical bodies, there's a limit to what we can do with that. But if we begin to understand ourselves as being transcendent of the physical body and also transcendent of the physical world, that opens up a great question, which is, who exactly am I and where are my limits? If I'm not bounded by my skin, then how am I bounded? And what is my relationship to other people? If you listen to saints and shamans and gurus and mystics throughout the time, they've always talked about this fact that this world of separation that you and I live in our daily lives is really an illusion. That underneath all of that, we are all one. That there is this essential unity that is undeniable from that perspective. And I think that's where one of the real benefits begins to open up, not just for ourselves, but also for the whole world. Because if you have that experience of being one with another person, then it changes the way that you deal with that other person. Jesus said, for instance, that when you have done it to one of the least of these, you have done it unto me. And so he wasn't, from my perspective, talking about just a nice golden rule way to do interface with the world. He was talking about the fundamental reality that we miss most of our lives. And so if you and I are one, it's pretty tough for me to abuse you. if I look at somebody from another part of the world and they're different from me, either culturally or from a racial perspective, it's pretty tough for me to neglect them and to just go on with my life as if they don't exist or to exploit them. So for me, the real hope for peace in the world comes about as we begin to explore this deep, deep question, which is, who am I? And how do I know myself? Because as I know myself, then I'm also beginning to know those around me as part of myself and an expression of this marvelous mystical oneness that is the ground of all being.
Paul, when we that's really important to mention is how when we realize that we're connected and we realize our oneness, that we aren't able to have hatred for another person or to hurt another person. But what about all those people? I mean, it is really more people are coming to this realization, but is that enough for it to be a tipping point? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, there are still so many people that are stuck in this not paying attention, even people who are spiritually seeking. I mean, it seems to be elusive. We'll have that feeling and that realization for a moment, and then, you know, next week we're dealing with a trauma or whatever, and we tend to forget that and lose our connection. So how can we take that from where it is now and move it to a place beyond where we're actually impacting the world on a global expansive sense?
Yeah, again, that's a great question, and I think I would be facetious to say that I knew the answer to that. But I think that, you know, it is my hope that as more and more of us engage in this perspective that transcends the normal limits of what we think is appropriate from a cultural perspective, that there will be a tipping point. And I think one of the keys to that tipping point, and I think it's another benefit of this kind of work, is that when people engage this question of who am I, they also engage the question of, all right, if I'm not who I thought I was and I'm something different from that, then why exactly have I come into this world? And then you're asking the question of this deep passion that each of us has been imbued with, this unique calling, if you will, that is our unique challenge for this world. And I think the more people engage in their particular passion, whether that be, you know, passion regarding your work or passion regarding an artistic endeavor or writing or anything that enhances the beauty of this world, that also changes the energetic and the dynamic of the dominant culture. And I think that, you know, in the Western world, we've become so dominated by the economic worldview that the more people start to embrace other things that go beyond the economic worldview, that changes the way we engage the world and the earth itself, too, so that we engage this a more whole perspective of what it means to be human, because it isn't just about the paycheck that we're making. It really is about our spiritual essence and our soul essence and bringing that into the discussion of everything that we do in this world.
Okay, but even when you were working as a minister, I mean, you dealt with that. You knew logically and you knew what Jesus said about not getting hung up on where the paycheck's coming from. But even you as a minister, having studied that and having these spiritual experiences, you still got stuck in that.
Absolutely.
So how do us average Joes who haven't studied the Bible for decades and we're not the executive director of the Monroe Institute, if you're struggling with that, how do we get out of that?
Well, first of all, just remember that I'm an average Joe, too. And regardless of what I've done in my life, you know, I'm just an ordinary person trying to get through like anybody else. It's always a battle. It really is. You know, we always go back and forth between this deep calling, this yearning that propels us forward, and this other part of us that is deeply engaged in the physical world and is very concerned with survival. So I don't think, again, it's an either-or situation. It's more a question of, you know, how can you find those times when you're able to make room for the other things in life that aren't strictly tied up with this issue of survival of the physical body? And there are many different ways to do that. I mean, certainly you can come to the Midrall Institute and engage that in a process that's pretty effective. But engaging in daily meditation, reading, following your passion in terms of artwork or music or dance or you name it. It's listening to that inner voice as much as you possibly can, even though that voice may not be appreciated or respected by the larger culture. The more you listen to that and the more you have the courage to make those little decisions every day that will move you in the direction of your soul or spirit, the easier it becomes over time. So it's a process. We're all changing, and it's not an easy process at all, but I think that more and more people are starting to move in that direction.
Wonderful. It sounds like what you're saying is that it takes practice.
It certainly does. It takes practice. And as I say, it takes a little bit of courage along the way to make those hard decisions when you know that you actually might be disappointing some other people along the way.
Okay, that's fair. So, Paul, I want to know about, I've read in your book about some of the things that you experienced at the Monroe Institute, but what really goes on there? You're listening to this hemi-sync. Is that the same as meditation? Because you mentioned meditation as a spiritual practice.
Mm-hmm. It's. I think that we engage in a variety of perceptions, and sort of the meditation state can be one of them. Early on, you talked about the out-of-body experience, and that kind of has become what we have been known for simply because the founder, Robert Monroe, wrote three books in which he was chronicling his experiences in going out of body. But over the years, we've come to realize that the out-of-body state is just one of a very broad range of possible perceptions and experiences for human beings. They can be, in addition to that, light meditation, heavy meditation, the dream state, lucid dreaming, creative states. Those who are in a coma are also in a different state of awareness. These are all available to human beings. And so what we do at the Institute is we create a context which allows people to begin to explore these other ranges of experience that ordinarily they would pass off and simply not give much attention to. The way that we do that is that if you think about when you go to sleep at night, you may realize that you get progressively more and more relaxed until you come to this threshold where all of a sudden you lose consciousness. You forget that you have a physical body back in the physical world, and you go off on these journeys that you remember later on upon waking as dreams or lucid dreams or visions, call them what you will. What we do at the Institute is we help people to move into that progressive relaxation and then come up to that threshold where they would normally fall asleep, but allow them to maintain awareness and consciousness as they cross over that threshold so that they can begin to explore these other areas of awareness and perception with the adult waking mind so that they can bring back those experiences into this physical world. And so when you cross over that threshold, you don't forget that you have a body that's lying in a bed, and you don't forget that you have this other world, this mundane world with a life that you have to live, but you're able to integrate the two. And so you're kind of using, in some regards, the left part of the brain to begin to explore the wonders that are available to the right part of the brain. So that's what we do, is we use sound patterns that help people to move into these ranges of experience while still staying awake and alert.
Okay, cool. I wanted to ask you, I borrowed the gateway experience from someone.
Okay.
So is that the one that you're still using, the hemi-sync?
Yeah, the gateway experience, that's actually the home study course that was developed a number of years ago for people who can't come to the Institute. And so that's a good way for a lot of people to begin this exploration without it without it costing them an arm and a leg to do so. But so what was your experience like when you borrowed that?
Well, I'm still just learning because I haven't, I didn't go through the whole thing because I feel like I'm not, I don't know exactly how quickly you're supposed to go through it, but I didn't feel like I had mastered like Focus 10 yet.
Right.
And so Focus 10 is where you're supposed to be awake in your brain, but your body's asleep, right?
Right. That's what we call the mind-awake, body-asleep state. And the reason why, by the way, it's called Focus 10 was that we wanted to put a numerical designation on the different focus states because we didn't want to prejudice people as to what those states might be like. And so the numbering system was the most neutral thing that we could think of.
Okay. Well, my experience with Focus 10, I think Focus 10, and then I was starting to move on to Focus 12. But what happened for me is that I was lying there and I felt something, but I didn't feel like my body was asleep because I kept like wanting to move or having an itch or, I mean, can you be in Focus 10 if your body is still feeling like it is restless?
Well, it depends on how restless. You know, the idea is that you want to be in that state where you are feeling relaxed, but that doesn't keep you from getting an itch. And we often tell people, you know, if you've got an itch, go ahead and scratch it because that's not going to pull you out of the state. But you're the only one that can really judge whether you're in that place. The idea is not for your body necessarily to be asleep, but it's for you to feel a sense of deep relaxation. If you think about how you feel just before you're falling asleep or if you're waking up in the morning before you're fully awake, you'll have that place where it's kind of a delicious kind of relaxation where your body just feels quite wonderful in that state. And if you can achieve that while you're still staying awake, then you have achieved the Focus 10 state.
Okay, cool. If people want to get that, because I borrowed it, so...
Mm-hmm.
Where can people get that? The Monroe Institute website?
Yes, and that Monroe Institute website is Monroe, that's M-O-N-R-O-E, institute.org, and that's .org because we are a nonprofit organization.
Wonderful. And I just wanted to ask you about Focus 12 as well, because in the book, in your book, A Spiritual Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe, towards the end, you mentioned how your wife is more of a feeling person, and she gets feelings in her body as opposed to you're a more visual person. So in Focus, I think it's Focus 12, in the early stages of the gateway experience, the person, is it Mr. Monroe who's speaking?
Yes, it is,
yeah.
Right.
So Mr. Monroe is saying, okay, so now just... feel how your body is going up and feel how nice that feels. And I can feel like a pulling of my body.
Oh,
but then
can?
When he
good.
Talks about, but then I get the sense that I'm supposed to kind of turn over and see my body, but I can't, I just feel that sort of pull, but I don't actually like exit my body. Is that normal?
Right. Well, first of all, understand that the out-of-body experience, and we tell people this right from the start, that if you're coming to the Monroe Institute looking for an out-of-body experience, we cannot guarantee that at all. Robert Monroe used to estimate that maybe 15% of the people who come through the program actually have an out-of-body experience. But the rest of the people who go through, the vast majority of them, find some other state or perception that is so compelling that the out-of-body experience just doesn't even matter anymore. And that was really what happened to me. I've never had an experience where I've risen out of my body, turned around and looked at it, and saw myself lying in the bed from another position. That simply has just not been part of my experience. But I can tell you that when I went to the Institute the first time, so many other things happened to me that I did not care about the out-of-body experience at all, because I began to realize that there is literally a cornucopia of perceptions and experiences that are available to us as we enter into those states. And really what happens is we get the experience that we need most, because there is a a guidance and a genius that is carrying us as we move through this process. So where one person might actually have that experience of getting out of their body and turning around and seeing it, somebody else is going to have something else happen to them that is going to be exactly what they need and is going to change their perspective in the way that's best for them. So I would say you probably are in the majority if you didn't have that happen to you.
Okay. Is it something that you can, I mean, because I just tried it a couple times, and I haven't, I've been pretty busy, so I haven't put the time aside to actually do it. Can you be, like, in a place where you're not having an out-of-body experience, and then with practice maybe you will?
Certainly, that's a possibility, because it's like anything else. It's kind of like riding a bike, you know. You've got to practice for quite a while before you get to that balance point that works for you. Or, you know, as I say, you may be so fascinated by something else that your attention is completely drawn away from that. So if you feel like you actually are really interested in that, I would encourage you to continue to experiment with it, because the more you practice, the more likely it is to happen for you.
Fun. Okay.
I was going to say, the other thing that's important in this is to realize that it's much more difficult trying to do these kinds of things at home on your own, because life has a way of crowding in. So maybe you get to do it on Tuesday. You get to do one experience. And then by the time you get around to it again, maybe it's Friday before you can do it again, or Saturday morning. And so what happens is that the baseline of your awareness doesn't get a chance to shift, because you go into the experience and you kind of come back to where you were before you started. Whereas if you're going to a retreat setting like we have at the Institute, where you're building one experience on top of the other, on top of the next one, on top of the next one, the overall baseline of your awareness starts to shift in a subtle way. And it isn't sometimes even until you get to the end of the seminar where you realize how much you have changed and how far you've come in that. So the ability to get away and not be distracted can be a real benefit as you move into these ranges, because you're focusing all of your attention on that, but B, you're also allowing one experience to build on the other without it being dissipated in between.
Wonderful. Well, I wanted to ask you a question about your experience at Focus 21, but first, Anita MC in the chat room wants to know, do you meet interdimensional beings when you are in those states of consciousness?
I have, and as have many others as well. It's not guaranteed that that's going to happen to any person, but if that's a part of what is supposed to happen to you, yes, absolutely. I don't know whether you had started to say you were going to ask me a question about my experience, and you know, was it about something where I could relate that experience of where I encountered interdimensional beings?
I'm sure we can tie it in. Well, in Focus 21, you saw this kind of city that was like a glowing, colorful city, and
right.
I was just curious, because you said that you hadn't had, that out-of-body experiences weren't part of your experience, but that going to that city, that wasn't an out-of-body experience?
Well, again, you know, the language is so difficult with this stuff, because, when I think about it, when I reflected on it from your perspective, I'm thinking, well, yeah, I guess maybe you would call it an out-of-body experience, but I never called it that myself. I think probably because when I think of an out-of-body experience, and this is really not appropriate to think this way, but I kind of equate it with, you know, coming out of your body, turning around and seeing your physical form in some way. And that, because that's never happened to me, I have trouble putting the out-of-body label on it. But you're right, when you're looking at it from a different perspective, yeah, I was in this other dimension, and even though I didn't see my physical body, I knew that I had a physical body that was still lying there in bed. So, well, anyway, let's go on to the experience, and you be the judge. So here I am in Focus 21, which, according to our terminology, is the bridge state between physical reality and non-physical reality. And I find myself flying over this city of light. And the reason why I call it a city of light is because the buildings are glowing from within. It isn't as if they've got neon signs or electric lights, but the actual materials of the building seem to have this luminescence to them. And it is absolutely one of the most beautiful things I've ever encountered in my life. I mean, and there was a visceral reaction to the wonder and the beauty of that place. And so I'm going through the city, and at one point I turn into a building, and I see this being of light, and I think it's very similar to the being of light, maybe even the same one that I fell, that I encountered when I fell off the roof. But I know that I was supposed to have a conversation, but I was so excited to be there, I rushed out of the building because I wanted to see the city. Another point, I went into this cathedral or arena, I guess would be the best way to say it, and there are people of light who are arranged in a sort of a semicircle, and you know, just thousands of them, and I engage another person who is of light and in a conversation, but then I go running out of there and have these other experiences. So you would consider those to be interdimensional beings, getting back to Anita's question. And for me, that was what they were. And so that experience of going into Focus 21 showed me that there are other dimensions that are available to us that we can experience as normal human beings. And one of the things that was most compelling about that to me was that when I was in that arena and they were looking at these thousands of beings of light, there was a woman off to my right who was not a light person but seemed much more like I was. When we came back to talk about our experiences within the group, one of the first women to speak said, you know, I went to the city of light, and she began to describe a lot of the things that I had experienced. I thought, oh my gosh, you mean somebody else went to the same place I did? This is amazing. And nobody else mentioned it, so I couldn't stand it anymore. So I raised my hand and I said, I went to the city of light too. And the woman across the room from me looked at me and she said, yes, I know. I saw you there. And so that was a really amazing and compelling thing for me to think that we can, as human beings, go into these altered states of perception, and two people can come away with very similar, if not identical, experiences and then talk about them afterwards. It was the first time I had a sense that maybe this is a whole lot more than just our imagination that was happening.
So, Paul, you in your book, you talk about your kind of your first experience there, but now that you're the executive director of the Monroe Institute, I mean, have you gone back to this light city and had more experiences?
Yes, I have on occasion, and it's still one of my most favorite places to go. You know, there are certain structures in that place that have become fairly familiar to me, but I have to say that now my journey seems to be taking on a little bit of a different twist, and it's more not so much about going out into these other realms, but engaging this world in a different way than I had before. And I think, especially since I've taken this job as executive director, I seem to notice that the intuition aspect of my life has really been ratcheted up quite a bit, and it seems that I get exactly the right information that I need at exactly the right time, and I come across the person that I need to talk to, and there's more of a, I don't know, it's more like a symphony, I guess, than my life used to be before. And I think that's the biggest change that I've noticed in my life in recent years, and it's really quite interesting for me.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that your work with the Monroe Institute and your inner work has now started to spill over and to actually have physical impact in your outer world.
I that's a really good way to say it. I think you said it better than I could. And I think that's true. There seems to be more of an integration, whereas before I was so frustrated in my work and so, I just simply didn't enjoy it all that much, and there was a real need for me to get away from this physical world to get some relief from some of that. now that because I'm so close to following my own passion, there's a much more integrated sense of being connected both with this physical world and also with the guidance that helps me to navigate it. So it's a really a different quality of being.
Well, Paul, we just have a few minutes left in the show, and I have lots more questions, but I know you're going to be joining me on Synchronicity Radio in a couple of weeks, so if you're interested, if you're listening right now and you're interested in continuing on this conversation with Paul Rademacher, check out my website, spiritualshow.com, because we'll be having him on for another hour on my other radio show. Thank you so much, Paul, for being with us tonight. I'm wondering... I'd like to give you the floor to say anything that you'd like to say, either about your book, A Spiritual Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe, or the Monroe Institute. What would you like to leave our listeners with tonight?
Well, how much time do I have?
You've got 4 minutes.
4 minutes? Oh, okay.
Plenty of time.
Well, I want to make sure I don't run over on this. Well, I guess the main thing that I was trying to communicate in the book is this idea that that the kingdom of heaven that Jesus talked about, from my perspective, and you don't have to believe this if you don't want to, but from my perspective, is not really so much about what happens to us after we die, whether we're going to heaven or hell, but it really is more about how we engage our life in this moment, because there is something precious about this life. Each one of us have chosen to be here for a reason, and I think that we've come here because we can learn things in this reality that might not be available to us in other dimensions. And so we've come here out of a sense of choice and out of a sense of purpose. And so part of that for me is to understand that not only are we more than our physical bodies, but we're much more than our jobs and much more than the immediate thing that's in front of us, that there's sort of a narrative arc to our life, and that as we move closer and closer to our passion, we also get a better sense of who we are in our deepest manner of thinking and being. And that's to know ourselves as from the essential qualities of our soul and also from the essential qualities of our spirit, to know that part of us that transcends this world and continues to live on even after the physical body dies. So for me, when Jesus was talking about the kingdom of heaven, he was talking about that engagement of the transcendent state that is available as our birthright in this world and to ordinary people. And it isn't something we have to wait for until we die. And so the thing that I would encourage people so much to do is to really engage that deep question within themselves that all of us carry if we're really paying attention. And that is that yearning for something more than just the physical accoutrements of this life. So if you're feeling that yearning or feeling that longing, it's not something to be pushed away. It is something to be engaged, because that's sort of the beacon that is calling each of us to our deepest sense of being and the passion that is at the very center of our lives and our unique purpose for coming into this world. So I just leave you with that. Go on the journey and enjoy it as you go.
Thank you so much, Paul. It was such a wonderful hour, and I'm looking forward to having you on Synchronicity in a couple weeks.
It'd be my pleasure, Marie, and thanks so much for having me.
Wonderful. Oh, and where's the best place for people to get your book?
Well, they can get it at Amazon.com. Barnes & Noble bookstores, a lot of them are carrying the book. You can get it through BarnesandNoble.com, or you can order it through our website, or you can go to my website, which is SpiritualHitchhiker.com.
Wonderful. And there's also a link on the blog talk page that goes to the Amazon book. There's a little picture, so if you're in the book, just push the button and it'll take you there.
Thank you so much, Marie. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Paul. Have a wonderful evening.
You too.
Take care. Bye-bye. Thank you so much for being with us this evening. What a wonderful conversation. Thank you for joining us in the chat room and joining us energetically. It was just such a pleasure to spend this hour with you. I look forward to being with you next week. We will have Yvonne Rados on, and he is a Namaste author, and he will be talking about how you can transform your life through sacred geometry. So I'm really interested in learning more about that next week here on Namaste Radio. Until then, be well. Namaste.
Thank you for joining with us for this hour of Namaste Radio. For further spiritual insights and sharing, please join us in Namaste Global Community at namastepublishing.com. If you enjoyed the show, please add Namaste Radio as a friend, favorite the show, and tell someone about it. Sharing this show is a precious gift that's completely free. Thank you. May you enjoy each moment of your day. Namaste.